Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
You can subscribe to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast, at iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite download service, and never miss the great content we offer. The views expressed in this presentation are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. Army War College, U.S. Army, or Department of Defense.
Welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Ron Granieri, professor of history at the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College and podcast editor of the War Room. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Since the formation of the 10th Special Forces Group Airborne in 1952, there has been a certain mystique around Army Special Forces. By 1962, President Kennedy called their headgear, the Green Beret, quote, a symbol of excellence, a badge of courage, a mark of distinction in the fight for freedom. Even as the range and role of Special Operations Forces has grown within the Army and in the other services, the Green Berets maintain a special hold on the public imagination, immortalized in song by Barry Sadler and on film by John Wayne. Fame, however, is not the same as public understanding. And even the most self-confident organizations experience identity crises as they age. Today, the Green Berets struggle with both public misperceptions about their role and internal tensions over their identity. Understanding and resolving this identity crisis should be of interest to anyone interested in effective special forces as a vital element in national strategy. Our guests, Major General John Brennan, Brigadier General Steve Marks, and Colonel Ed Crute, are deeply familiar with both the role of the Green Berets and the challenges facing them going forward, and join us today to discuss the nature of the current identity crisis and possible solutions. To introduce our guests, Major General John Brennan is the commanding general of 1st Special Forces Command. He has served in the Special Operations community since completing the Special Forces qualification course in 1995 and is a graduate of North Carolina State University, the Air Command and Staff College, and the U.S. Army War College Fellows Program at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Brigadier General Steve Marks is the Deputy Commanding General of 1st Special Forces Command. The majority of his 28 years of service have been within Special Operations Units, and he is a graduate of the University of Missouri, the Army's Command and General Staff College, the Naval Postgraduate School, and the U.S. Naval War College. Colonel Ed Crute is Special Forces Command's Chief of Staff. He is a Green Beret with 25 years of service in the Army, and he recently completed the Counterterrorism and Public Policy Fellowship at Duke University, where he conducted research on the current culture and identity of the U.S. Special Forces. Welcome to A Better Peace, gentlemen. So I want to start with a question for you, General Marks, if I may. Who are the Green Berets?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to say thank you very much for having us on your podcast. This is a great opportunity for us to, one, highlight the great work of Colonel Ed Crute and what he worked on and as part of his thesis for the War College. So when you ask me what and who are the Green Berets, I would say that we are the nation's premier partnership force who specialize in the indigenous approach, conducting operations by, with, and through partnered forces. But for me personally, I go down and see the battalions and down at the company level and team level. And when I talk to Green Berets, I have my own definition of who Green Berets are. So for me, Green Berets are quiet professionals. We are adaptive problem solvers, honorable warriors, masters of unconventional partnered operations, all for a higher cause to free the oppressed. And so I use that as a way to kind of articulate for them in my own terms who we are and what we stand for. We were formed in 1952 out of the Psychological Warfare Forces with some veterans of the 1st Special Service Force and Office of Strategic Services. We've been involved going all the way back to the Cold War, training anti-Soviet guerrillas. In Vietnam, we were instrumental in unconventional warfare and counterinsurgency operations. And then most recently in Afghanistan, post 9/11, we were known as the horse soldiers because of how we infiltrated and came in from the north of Afghanistan and conducted operations in the north. Our doctrinal missions are unconventional warfare, foreign internal defense, security force assistance, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, direct action, counterproliferation, special reconnaissance, and preparation of the environment. So a lot of core activities. And so it's often hard to pinpoint exactly who we are. So I think the chance for us to correct any of those misperceptions or misunderstandings is exactly what we are here to do, myself, General Brennan, and Colonel Crute. And that's why I think the fact that Colonel Crute was able to pinpoint that we were having a identity crisis, and not only that, oftentimes does the public get us wrong, but often we get it wrong ourselves within our own community. And so his efforts and his thesis of identifying the problem and then providing valuable solutions or recommendations has been instrumental for the overall community.
Thank you, General. Well, let's turn to Colonel Crute. Based on your research at the War College, what do you mean when you talk about an identity crisis? General Marks just listed a series of doctrinal missions. I suppose it shouldn't be surprising that an organization that has 9 possible doctrinal missions would have something of an identity crisis. But what do you mean by it based on your research?
Yes, Dr. Granieri, appreciate the opportunity as well. A long research project that I'm going to try and sum up in about 3 minutes. So I think it's best to first start with what I saw personally as a professional Green Beret. And I started to notice it was unrecognizable, some things that I was hearing some of our younger Green Berets say. And as you heard General Marks mention, we are the premier partnership force. But I had young sergeants and captains talking about unilateral operations and not valuing language and conversations. So I was concerned for about the last 6 or 7 years somehow we were losing our way. As I went to the War College, they said, hey, listen, at Duke, you need to pick a topic to research that you're passionate about and that can give back to your profession. And so I was very passionate about this topic. I then started to read some articles that were mentioning identity crisis within special forces. And then finally, when I read Lieutenant General Baudet, the USASOC commanding general's strategy in October of last year, he also said, hey, we need to have a mindset change to get back to the strategic direction for what we need to be doing. And so from that point, I launched on looking at what is an identity crisis. Now, an identity crisis does not mean it's something we can't recover from or it's irreversible by any means. It's very common. The definition of it is when there's a period of uncertainty or confusion that individuals or groups experience where their identity becomes somewhat insecure. And it is usually due to a change in expectations of that group. And so that was very recognizable to me. September 11th was a major strategic shift in which Green Berets were asked to go forward and conduct counterterrorism operations. And at times that became unilateral away from a partner. So with that definition in mind, my research project ended up surveying 1,200 active duty Green Berets. And the methodology and the design that Duke's PhD team helped me set up was to try and determine if we had misalignment between the 25 attributes and skills and missions that Green Berets are supposed to be able to conduct according to Title 10 law, our doctrine, and our policy, and the Green Berets themselves, their behaviors and beliefs. And so we measured 25 of those archetypes, and I found that 19 were misaligned to some degree in either Green Berets' beliefs or behaviors. And so the audience can understand, I'll just give two quick examples. Language. So we're directed by law to be able to have a language capability. 29% of the force don't believe that we need to have that skill. And then a further 62% of our population are not maintaining that language. Another example, 34% reported beliefs that they are really not committed to a partnership approach and that it's often better to unilaterally accomplish that mission. And then another final piece, hostage rescue. A skill set that other organizations are uniquely trained, manned, and equipped to do. Our force at 25% said, yes, that's an appropriate mission for us. So the final piece is my research finding was that we have three sub-identities at work within Green Berets. 26% direct action. And what that means is that's more of the, we do hostage rescue. It's better if we do things unilaterally. We don't value the partnership approach or language. A legacy identity, which was about 28%, and that group they harken back to pre-9/11, and that the Green Beret mission is simply to be forward partnered training forces and to be ready for a conflict role for unconventional warfare. And then finally, and I think this is a very positive sign, 46% or almost half of our force, I call them the modern identity, they do align with all 25 archetypes, and they understand our modern role in what the NDS or the National Defense Strategy is asking us to do, which is to be persistently present forward, competing daily with our partners against Russia, China, Iran, and DPRK. And so that's a good sign. So the question then becomes, is there an identity crisis? I claim that there is. Mm-hmm. And finally, that it is a good sign that about half of our force is there. So the question is hearkened for our command. What do we do about the other two identities or the other 50% of the force?
I have to ask you one question about your study is how much of the feedback that you got from Green Berets was from written surveys versus were you able to conduct any interviews with young or experienced Green Berets?
Yes, I was. It's a great question. Mm-hmm. So it was a 44-question survey. And then at the end, mm-hmm. of course, the last question was, what else would you like to add to this? And of the 1,200 Green Berets that responded, I had probably about 250 that asked for follow-on discussions and whatnot. And in addition, they produced over 100 pages of written feedback talking about their feelings on this problem.
Fascinating. Well, very good. Thank you, Colonel Kroot. General Brennan, I want to turn to you as someone with deep experience and the man in charge. Do you agree with Colonel Kroot's findings? And how did we get to this identity crisis, if such exists from your perspective?
Yes, I absolutely agree with Ed's findings. I wish mm-hmm. he'd have done this survey back in the 90s, frankly, because we're really back to the future. Mm-hmm. We've had these micro identities since I was a team leader back in 3rd Special Forces Group in the 90s. So you had folks, their identity was based on their team's mission. So if you were an SR or a DA team, your focus was special reconnaissance and direct action. And the partnership piece was kind of an afterthought. And so there was a bit of a difference in culture and how folks were training. The hard standard was always unconventional warfare. And we would get back to that, but based on a team's mission guidance letter, that's what they put their efforts into. And frankly, I had commanders that told me, hey, we speak two languages here, 5.56 and 7.62 being the caliber of our weapons. And never tell your partners everything you need to know. They need to know because you'll have to come back one day and potentially kill them. So that kind of identity permeated in certain sects of the different at the team level, all the way up to, you know, battalion and group level. Right. So I totally agree with what Ed's project. Now we have the data to back up what we think we already knew. And then really the last 20 years of counterterrorism, we had to modernize and we had to adjust how we did business for the last 20 years to focus on, you know, counterterrorism, Al-Qaeda, with combat operations going on simultaneously, to kill terrorists in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, as well as the Far East and the Philippines. So that's been our focus. We modernized. We've learned a lot during the last 20 years, what works, what does not. And we've, I think, adjusted our approach to that end. And now we have to kind of come back to what we were doing in the 90s, which was peacetime competition, to understand the NDS threats that are out there and really provide that information to decision makers while simultaneously working with partners to be the partner of choice and to deter conflict in the future.
Mm-hmm. General Brennan, your experience as a team leader, you got at a very interesting point there about the tension between the Green Berets' role as a trainer, a partner, and as a direct actor. And obviously, it's a problem for a lot of educators in any kind of conversation, is if you have to be really good at the subject in order to teach it. But then once you try to teach it to someone, if you think it's important that something gets done, it's very easy to become frustrated with your students, if you were, that they're not doing the work, and just to do it yourself. How did you, as a team leader, and how do Green Berets in general sort of try to deal with the idea that, yes, the mission is important, but if it's to deal with a partner, that sometimes you have to let the partner either succeed or fail?
That's a very good question, because we are really selected and trained as type A personalities. So
right.
Failure is probably the thing that our folks fear most in their life. And, you know, really it's the leader's jobs to keep the main thing the main thing. So if the most important thing about our action is that our partners are successful, that's what has to happen. And we cannot be the ones going through the door first. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the bigger objective may be political, and it may not be that tactical act right at that moment. And we have to, as leaders, tell our subordinates that and make sure they understand that. And because doing something that makes sense tactically might be gratifying at that time, you could actually fail the overall mission, which is to make your partner successful, or to keep the U.S. from being dragged into a conflict, or to be able to obfuscate our hand in a specific operation. Does that make sense?
It sure does. No, and I can understand the challenge, and especially the very what it is an interesting paradox that the very things that we train Green Berets to be able to do and to be proactive, to be problem solvers, that to remember what the problem is that you're actually trying to solve is a challenge. And that leads me back to you, Colonel Crute. Do you find that there are structural reasons for this identity crisis that have led us to where we are today?
Yes. And I think, again, a little bit of context to answer that question. When I got all of these results, I struggled for about a month and a half with what the force was telling me. And I took a cut at it. Duke PhD team immediately responded to me that, hey, listen, you're confusing your cause, effect, and your problem. And so we really need to go back to the cultural and behavioral and identity sciences to help make sense of what you found. And so there's some works out there. Dr. Shine from MIT, widely recognized as a group cultural expert that most other behavioral scientists refer to, and then a team named Fisher and Weekly. And the two concepts that we need to understand is, number one, when you talk about identity, ethic, and culture, it's really important to understand that an individual's identity and ethic is formed as they're entering into adulthood. And it's formed by the adults in their life as they were raised. And identity and ethic are also very, very hard to change as the person gets older. Second concept is a concept of socialization. So when an individual is coming into an organization, a culture, a group, they're going to go through three stages. First, pre-arrival; second, encounter; and third, metamorphosis. Now, we overlay in the military recruiting base over pre-arrival, training and education base over encounter, and operational base over metamorphosis. And so when we look at those three phases, the first thing that catches the attention of the scientists is, wow, you are socializing across three different two-star commands. So USAREC, where we recruit from, the Special Warfare SWIC, we call it here at Fort Bragg, our training and education base. And then third, when they get to General Brennan's organization, the 1st Special Forces Command, our operations base. And so on the first part of this, the recruiting message then therefore has to be absolutely authentic to what you do, because that's the type of person you're going to attract in their core identity and ethic. And so if your recruiting message is not authentic, it will only cause confusion for the individual and problems for the organization later. And I just did a quick look. I did spend 2 years in the United States Army Recruiting Command. And so I looked back at the current message, and I absolutely saw we were overrepresenting direct action in our recruiting message and underrepresenting that partnership role. And so the next piece of this and final piece is, if you have differing identities throughout your organizations, there's going to be a problem when you're socializing individuals. So let's take one of those staff sergeants that's only doing one tour of duty with special forces because he's disenfranchised, if you will, and getting out, that called and wanted to talk to me face to face, excuse me, on the phone. He explained his experience like this. I was recruited to special forces to conduct direct action. When I got to the Q course, the qualification course, excuse me, at Fort Bragg, I was a little confused as I went through and learned about partnership and language and with and through approaches, and actually had different instructors telling me different things. So one instructor representing, yep, it's about partnership. Another representing, it's about unconventional warfare. Third, yeah, we do direct action. I only fired my weapon twice in the entire year-long Q course, so I was confused. Then when I got to my unit, I had a team sergeant that talked about direct action only, a team leader that talked about our role in competing with Russia and China when we go forward on our missions, and then my company commander talked about unconventional warfare as our mission. And so I ask you, Colonel Crute, who am I supposed to be? And what he described, when you apply that quote over what I'm seeing, what I saw in the research, you can see how if he was recruited direct action, that's what he was expecting. When he got to the qualification course and didn't experience that, he was confused. When he got finally to his organization, he then gravitated to the like identity of his direct action team sergeant, and that's where he sought culture and comfort, in a sub-identity, not the overall identity of the organization.
Interesting. Well, that is fascinating, and we could have a whole podcast discussion on the whole question of recruiting command and what kind of messages are used to recruit but I'll set that aside for a second because I want to go to you, General Marks, based on what Colonel Crute was just talking about. Is if there are problems with messaging, if there are problems with the presentation of the force, what role can or should the uniformed senior leaders and the civilian leadership play in helping the Green Berets to make clear what their identity is and to overcome this current crisis?
So as Ed just mentioned, the employment of the force is a big part of reinforcing an identity, either good or bad. So we can say all day that we need a modern SF identity to do what our nation is asking of us. But if we are constantly asked to do nothing but counterterrorism or direct action strikes, that identity goes out the window pretty fast.
Right.
So one thing is making sure we are given clear and achievable goals that fit within that modern special forces identity framework. So our forces don't get pulled too far outside our lanes and where we provide the most value. And we're already seeing this happening in places at Special Operations Command and U.S. Army Special Operations Command, where our senior leaders are really starting to scrutinize the requests that are asking for special forces to either partner up with certain host nations. And we are seeing that that they are scrutinizing those missions and making sure that we are the right fit and we are the right force of choice. So I believe that we're already moving in the right direction.
Well, that's good. Well, and General Brennan, as the man at the top here, how do you see the specific role of the leadership of the special forces to shape this identity crisis, to deal with it?
Well, I think first what we have to do, and Ed's data has been invaluable in doing it, and Steve has also helped me with the messaging to the troops, as he's already talked about. So we talk when we go out and engage with all the troops, regardless of the formation. We have to have a common vision of who we are and what we're for. That goes from the recruiting piece all the way through onboarding once they're in their unit of action, all the way through to retirement, really. So who we are is quiet professionals, problem solvers who excel in ambiguity, and we're the partners of choice. And that's regardless if you're a special forces NCO, civil affairs officer, PSYOP NCO, that identity has to be the same and commonly understood by everybody. And then what we're for, we partner with resistance forces. We either create a resistance force to overthrow an occupying power, or we enable a force to prevent someone from overthrowing them. At the end of the day, you boil it down, that's what we do. And we use all the tools we have available to do that. And so just fixing that common baseline of understanding, I think, is hugely helpful. And then it requires repetition. And then we have to talk about how we are modernizing. And really, I think it's back to the future, really, because when I first came in the Army, the Soviet Union was still around. So that competing with a great power is nothing new. Right. And we play a key role in that. And we have to message to our troops that we are vital across the entire spectrum of conflict, whether we're just competing or we're up, you know, we have to train for large scale combat operations at the end of the day, but hopefully we never get there. And we're the force that helps prevent us from getting there. Mm-hmm. And we're also the nation's value proposition, because we can do things with a very small footprint with partners that don't require the U.S. government to send 18-year-old kids in tanks overseas to do. So we're the means to that end. And I think we got to just keep continually messaging that to our troops. And they're seeing it in the types of missions we're getting, because they're changing. Our footprints in Afghanistan and Iraq are shrinking, which is mm-hmm. providing us the opportunity to go back to what we used to do, which was more the peacetime competition role.
Right. Well, and as we approach the end of this conversation, believe it or not, some final thoughts. Colonel Crute, I want to turn back to you and say, after all your research, you know, obviously, if people want to know exactly what you think, they should read your report, or they should, after they listen to this podcast. But what is the message that you have for the Army and for the Joint Force based on what you've learned?
Yes, sir. I think first and foremost, when we talk about identity crisis, across the military, organizations, they go through this. There will be changes in mission, in expectations of them that they have to keep evolving toward. And so I think the Army went through this 2010, 2011. And when you had tankers and artillerymen not on their weapon systems, but patrolling streets in Iraq, Afghanistan, et cetera. And the Army identified that and had to go through this process to modernize and make sure that the culture and identity of the organization started to move in the right direction. And that's when they did the new series of ADPs. ADP 1 was created to define the Army. So this is something that's important to all Army and Joint Forces, and something that the leaders need to keep a pulse on, number one. Number two, I cannot thank my leadership enough. There was not a single hesitation from General Baudet, General Brennan, General Robeson, General Marks, in terms of conducting this research, having the access to our formation, and asking the hard questions. And that leadership courage is critical for an organization to be able to keep the pulse on its own organization. So you have to have that. General Clark at SOCOM has also looked at this and said, hey, I think there's a message for the Navy SEALs. I think there's a message for our brother Marines in MARSOC that they also probably should take a deep look at their culture and identity. And then my final message is going to be for my fellow students. And it's not just at the Army War College or like institutions, but also to our entire professional development system and any officer, NCO, or warrant officer that's going to embark on a research project. You know, this is going to be meaningful. The research has driven change. And that's what you asked me to do up front, was pick something you're passionate about and what you think there's a problem about. And so thanks to, at the very beginning, you know, Tim Nichols and the Duke team, Dr. Bolin and Phil Evans at the Army War College, you and Dr. Witt at the War Room, you have provided all of the tools necessary for me to ask the hard question and conduct valuable research that's going to help our force. So for the other students out there, I encourage you to invest that year when you're in education to be a meaningful exploration of your profession, because if you do a good job at it, there are leaders ready and willing to listen.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Ed. We always appreciate the plug for both the War Room, but also for the War College. And that's a good distillation of what we hope officers come away from their War College experience with. Turning to you, General Marks, what message do you have for First Special Forces Command, for all of the servicemen, service people, and units under your command?
Well, so we're First Special Forces Command. So we're the United States Army Special Operations Division. And a lot of folks don't realize that we're 23,000 strong. We're 11 brigades and 47 battalions. So we're the Army's largest division. We're uniquely organized, manned, trained, and resourced to operate in such complex and ambiguous environments. So they're soldiers from three interdependent Army Special Operations regiments that operate in small teams around the globe, strengthening relationships with our partners and our allies. So sometimes our name belies us a bit, because of the fact that a lot of folks don't think about civil affairs and psychological operations as being included in the RSOF division. But they are valuable partner, and they're part of the team, and they achieve the same great success on the battlefield and with our partner forces across the globe. I mean, at any given time, the new reality or the new normal COVID, we are operating around 3,000 soldiers from First Special Forces Command deployed throughout 70 different nations. I think as of Monday, we're around 52 different nations with just about 2,000 folks deployed, soldiers deployed globally. So we have some additional complexities, of course, when it comes to the question of identity. I would argue that the PSYOPs, or the psychological operations and civil affairs formations, have some of the same issues with purpose, identity, culture as their special forces counterparts. And so our command is looking at all of our forces. We're a multidimensional team that amplifies the value of each of the regiments by placing our folks onto cross-functional teams and letting the strengths of each team shine. So it's important that all of our forces are moving in the same direction with the same purpose and culture. That's why I think what Colonel Crute has identified and worked so hard for the last 12 and maybe even longer than that, his thesis has really shined a light on a potential problem. And I think the fact that he recognized it early and was able to provide some solutions, and that our senior leaders are listening to those recommendations that Colonel Crute provided, is invaluable. And thank you very much for this opportunity.
Oh, you bet, sir. Well, and General Brennan, I want to give you the last word. What does the future hold for Special Forces Command and for the Green Berets?
Well, Ron, I think the future is very bright. Our forces are more in demand now than ever before, despite the drawdowns in the combat zones. We've got nothing but requests for really things that we used to do, but also some unique things that we've never done before to help with our nation's security. So in that vein, to do those things, we are modernizing all of our regiments. We have what's called DCRs, .MLPF change requests in, to restructure and re-equip all of our formations to make them more pertinent in a A2AD environment to fight near-peer competitors. We also have a critical role in helping national leaders understand what's going on at the grassroots level all across the globe, so we can compete and win if we ever have to, if it comes to that. But obviously we will do everything we can to deter large scale combat operations for right. Everyone's benefit. But at the end of the day, we are modernizing and moving forward and carrying the same message of who we are and what we're for across all of our formations, so that we are a cohesive fighting unit. And really the power of our force is the power of combinations. So the partners we bring to bear across the joint, interagency, intergovernmental, and coalition are something that other divisions in the Army do not do. And that is what, you know, our value proposition to the nation is. We bring partners to bear at the right time and place to have the outsized effects.
All right. Well, thank you very much, General Brennan. Thank you, General Marks and Colonel Crute, for joining us today on A Better Peace for this conversation. Unfortunately, we're out of time for today, but I hope that that this conversation will inspire the listeners to explore these topics further and search up the very excellent research of Colonel Crute. But thank you to the three of you gentlemen for joining us today in A Better Peace. And thanks to all of you out there for listening in. Please send us your comments on this program and all of our programs. Send us suggestions for future programs. We're always interested in hearing what you think. We ask, please, that you consider subscribing to A Better Peace if you have not already. And also, if you subscribe, to rate and review this podcast on the podcatcher of choice, which helps others to find us. We're always interested in hearing from you, and we're always interested in expanding our audience for all of our conversations. But until next time, from the War Room, I'm Ron Granieri.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. and have a great day.